It's Wednesday, February 7th, 2024, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my School of Journalism colleagues Kathy Kiley and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, an Associated Press investigation 2 years in the making reveals how foods that are raised and processed that have been done so with prison labor and how that is finding its way into our food chain. We're days away from Super Bowl 58. We'll talk about the game, the ads, and of course, the latest about Taylor Swift. And one of the biggest newsmakers this week, interestingly enough, a Muppet. We're going to talk about the aftermath of Elmo's tweet checking in with followers. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to as well, but we're going to start with an ethical dilemma and the role of the journalist. Let's go to Boston, where columnist Kevin Cullen reported on the story of Linda Bluestein, a 76-year-old retired nurse who had terminal cancer. Because assisted suicide is not legal in her home state of Connecticut, Bluestein filed a lawsuit to go to Vermont and have her life ended there. She died on January 4th. Cullen's telling of her story is both touching and gut-wrenching at the same time, but there's a question as to whether he might have gotten a little too close and whether he crossed an ethical line. Here's what happened. Cullen was already working on the story when Bluestein was meeting with her doctor in Vermont. The doctor told her that to be able to move ahead, she would need to get the signatures of two people, unrelated to her, who could attest to her clear mental state at the time of her decision. Bluestein asked Cullen to be one of the signatories, and he did it. So herein lies the issue. Cullen, as a reporter working on this story, signed the form, helping her to end her life, and in turn, affected the outcome of the story he was reporting.
Well, absolutely. I mean, he did one of the things that we teach our students not to do, which is to become a part of the story themselves. It does happen, but generally it happens unavoidably. This was one where he clearly said, no, that's not my role. I can't be a chronicler of this and also be a participant at the same time. And so that was just a clear line that he basically crossed over.
Yeah, at the same time, I think the Boston Globe did the right thing in not spiking the story. I think they, as they said, this had been a long time in the making. It was a story of a woman that needed to be told. She's certainly not an expert on journalism ethics. And there were some great photographs with the story. And so I think they made the decision. First of all, he ultimately told his boss, which was a good thing. And then the editors were quite transparent. They had an editor's note when they ran the story. So, I totally agree with Ernest. It would have been better had he politely declined to sign the letter and said, you know, that's not my role here.
Right.
And explain that to the subject of the story. It's really hard because we are human beings as reporters. And I think there are times when, as you say, Ernest, it's that role of is thrust upon us and you have to make a decision. But here he could have said no. And so I think he did the wrong thing there, but then the Boston Globe did the right thing in how they handled it when they ran the story.
Right.
So I want to push back just a little bit, because what I'm hearing you say is, and I hear the part about it being a really good story and a woman's story that needed to be told, that she didn't understand journalism ethics. Okay, well, he very easily could have had that conversation, and why he is not the person to be the signer on that. But I also heard you say they had a lot of really good stuff with really good photos and they shouldn't have spiked the story because of what they had. When would you have walked away from that story then? What would have been your line?
Well, I think I think there are things that the reporter would have done. If it looked like the reporter had done something to create a story that wasn't there, then you spike the story. The story was there. It was a legitimate story. The reporter made one misstep that didn't ultimately affect the outcome of the story.
Sure it did, because if he didn't sign, then she may not have gotten the outcome that she was looking for.
Well, I think she would have found someone else.
Yeah.
I think she, at least from the way in which I interpreted it, it was convenience more than anything else. And maybe the fact that he had been chronicling her journey through this, she may have felt as if, you know, he was close enough to her to ask him to be able to do that. But I think that if he had said, no, this is not my role, I can't do this, she would have found someone else that she felt comfortable with.
Yeah, and I agree with that part, too. I just wonder if he really should have thought that one through. I'm sure he did think it through, but think through exactly where he
fit. I'm not sure he did. I mean, think about the emotion of the moment.
Yeah.
And as Ernest said, in some ways, this guy's quintessentially qualified because he had been following this woman through. I think, you know, this is not like a story where you just go up to the mayor and ask a quick question, in and out, that's it. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of story that requires developing a real intimacy with your sources. And so I can see why the woman would have asked him, and I can see why in the moment he would have said yes, because it was the human thing to do. And unfortunately, sometimes as journalists, we need to step back from that emotion. But I don't think, you know, nothing in any of the coverage suggested that this woman couldn't have found somebody else to attest to the fact that she was of sound mind when she signed this paper.
Right, right. I mean, to me, the other thing, too, is that, you know, it would have been smart for him to say, wait a minute, let me check, you know.
Yeah.
He could have easily called an editor who would have walked him through why this is not a good idea for you to do. I also would say that, as you said, Kathy, I commend the Boston Globe for being transparent about what the reporter had done and explaining why that was not appropriate and not, you know, basically just spiking the story and saying, well, you know, this is such a breach that we can't even tell the story because that story is still very much valid.
Yeah. The fact is there's no such thing as conflict-free journalism.
Right.
There's no such thing. There's always going to be a publisher with an interest or an advertiser or a funder.
Or a source.
And so So the question is, what do you do with that conflict? Mm. How do you handle it in the moment? And he handled it in a questionable way. But how transparent are you about it? And I think, you know, I think the Boston Globe showed a lot of, they were very ethical about how they handled this story.
Okay. So it has been a long time since we've had a chance to talk about individual stories that have been published throughout the week. And this week, we got two. So let's talk about another one. It's an investigation 2 years in the making that the Associated Press released this weekend about how prison labor is being used to grow, harvest, and process the food we eat.
We followed as cattle raised at the Louisiana State Penitentiary were transported to a meat processor in Texas. From there, the beef ended up in the supply chains of McDonald's, Burger King, and major grocery stores.
I felt like I had become a slave, a product of the convict system, because everything that I was doing was profiting the prison.
As I was reading this piece, watching the videos that went along with it, and fully grasping the level of exploitation of those incarcerated workers, I kind of kept hearing you, Ernest, saying to me, what about this surprises you? Of course this has been going on.
No, absolutely. I mean, this is a continuation of the peonage system that started right after Reconstruction, or actually toward the latter ends of Reconstruction. In the late 1800s, and if you grew up in the South as I did, you knew about these prisons. I mean, Angola, Sugar Land, which is outside of Houston, my hometown, and there was always this sort of convict labor that was going on. Either the labor was benefiting the prison, or prisoners were being leased out to various companies. It's always been happening. So this is, I mean, I commend the AP for the story, because now it sort of makes connections to many of the companies and corporations that we all know. But this system has always been there.
Yeah, one of the shocking things about the story, at least the print story, starts out in Angola, the prison in Louisiana, which is on the site of a former plantation.
Mm-hmm. And it was a long-standing peonage system prison. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's always been there.
Yeah,
it's the history of Angola.
Yeah.
But I think what AP did, and I just want to stop and say props to Ron Nixon, who has been just tearing it up since he became the chief investigative editor of the Associated Press. Just, they're doing incredible work. And to put 2 years into this investigation, that looks at people who are really among the most powerless and vulnerable people in our society. That's what great journalism is. But what it does, you know, as you said, Ernest, it's a secret that was hidden in plain sight, but it really details the conditions in which these people are working. There are people, and the story acknowledges that, who think that having people who are incarcerated work is a good thing, and that it helps them be productive. But there's no regulation. There's no labor regulations of these conditions, and you know, the accounts of the people who work there are really horrific. So I think for us as people who are buying groceries to be thinking about who might have produced that food, It's shocking that there's no regulation.
I mean, there are laws, policies, and processes that are in place to do the regulation you're talking about, but that doesn't stop bad actors.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much what's going on here. No one's actually there enforcing this.
Because there may be laws, policies, and regulations in place, but if there's no budget to hire the regulators.
Exactly.
Bad actors have their way.
Right, and so everyone goes back and say, "But we have policies in place." Well, okay,
who's
but you're not following
the policy is useless if you're not.
Policies,
if there's not someone to enforce
even
it.
The companies who are taking in
the product
mm-hmm. say that they have policies and processes not to do this. Well, if you're not checking, you know, then there you go. And so again. When you look at this, that's I think that's the thing that infuriates me most about this, is that this is happening in plain sight and people are okay with this. And a lot of it goes back to the fact that who are the incarcerated people to begin with? Most of them are people of color. Most of them are poor. Even whites who are in that system, and there are a lot of them. Mm-hmm. They come from poor situations. And you're talking about people who are incarcerated for petty theft, for minor drug use.
A lot of nonviolent crime as well.
Yeah, they don't have a political action committee.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you don't have white-collar criminals who are out in the field.
Martha Stewart.
That's not happening. Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And that, to me, is something that goes all the way back to history.
Well, and we've seen journalism like this, specifically in the areas of fast fashion, about, I don't know, I think back of like...
child labor. I mean,
right, Nike, about, yeah. Reebok, about forced slavery and people's habits changing. This, to me, felt that much more striking because we don't need fancy gym shoes or sneakers, but we all do need to eat. And we're all noticing the higher costs of food in grocery stores. And this is how costs are kept down, is this exploitation of the labor.
Or at least they say that's how costs is kept down. You know, someone is profiting off of this.
Yeah.
Okay. And part of it to me is, okay, if you're cutting your cost by using prison labor, then where's that excess profit going?
Well, the next step is to look at the C-suite salaries of all those corporations that are benefiting from incarcerated labor.
Right.
Okay. Let's lighten things up a bit and talk about the Super Bowl. because that's how Ernest just gave
but
me
people
the
are trying
up.
To make that serious.
Right, they are, though.
They're trying to politicize a football
are.
Game.
They are. And let's
shocking.
Actually, right? And let's, well, right, true. Football has been politicized for decades. But let's start there in the politics of football, because that word wasn't about to come out. So let's start with the Taylor conspiracies, which are still out there. The Taylor Swift conspiracy theories being pushed by the right, and this just being more and more and more about
I'm still trying to figure out what exactly she did that actually started all this. I mean, other than the fact that she started dating Travis Kelce,
yeah.
And she was on the field after the AFC Championship game, and what did she actually do that led those on the right to begin to use her as some sort of foil in?
She's in a symbol of women's empowerment.
Okay, there's a lot of those symbols out
yeah,
there.
Well,
why?
I
don't know.
Yeah.
Haters gotta hate.
Haters gotta.
There you go.
I guess
that was a nice touch there. One of the other Taylor Swift headlines going around this week: she is joining Elon Musk and going after the college student who is putting out the information, publicly available information, about the whereabouts of her private jet.
Yeah, this is kind of a funny story. It's a college student, as you said, who's using publicly available information on the internet to, it's really, as I understand it, it's kind of a climate change crusade.
Uh-huh.
He's tracking the carbon emissions of all these well-to-do people with their private jets. So so good luck with that. You know, anytime a celebrity titan goes after a college kid, in the court of public opinion, where is that going to go?
Yeah, that's a losing proposition from the
just
beginning.
Just kind of
looks
petty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The commercials, $7 million for a 30-second spot this go-around.
Well, there are stories out there to say it's worth it. I mean, if it's a good commercial and it attracts viewers that could potentially attract customers, I mean, that might be $7 million well spent. I mean, if you stop and look at it, I mean, some of these corporations are actually using prison labor, right? So there you go.
Exactly.
You know, I mean,
bringing it around
full
circle.
I don't mean to laugh. Yeah. You're kind of raising a good point.
That might be where that excess profit is going, is to buy a Super Bowl commercial.
To build goodwill.
Exactly.
And make people laugh.
And make people laugh or cry or feel sympathetic toward the product.
I feel like the Super Bowl is kind of like the Sundance for Stratcom.
Okay,
or Stratcom.
Oh, this is advertising. Yeah.
Because you get the sense that if you are a marketer or a PR person for a major corporation, this is your moment. You know, it's like your Mardi Gras. You've been building the float all year to come up with something.
And with such timing, with Mardi Gras being Tuesday.
Exactly.
Yeah. Go ahead.
But with innovation, and I always know my news hooks.
Uh-huh.
But the idea that you're just, everybody's competing to be the most innovative, the most emotive, the most, as they like to say, relatable, a word I hate. But, you know, and so it's this showcase for people who are just journalism adjacent, who are communicators for these corporations, to try to be the most imaginative out there. It's just a thing for that part of the industry.
Yeah.
Well, and it's kind of, you know, your chance at getting the largest audience of the year, right? Like worldwide.
Right.
And I will be the first to say, and apparently I've said it a whole bunch of times because it showed up in my Facebook memories this morning, that every year I say the only reason I'm watching the Super Bowl, like, I don't care about the game, I don't care about the commercials, I'm waiting to make sure I don't miss some huge cultural moment, mm-hmm. like the power going out,
yep.
or
a wardrobe malfunction.
And like I seem to post that on Facebook every year, but it becomes this like opportunity for collective memory and being afraid of missing out.
Because it's one of the few instances of appointment TV that's still left.
That's exactly right.
Where everybody's watching the same thing. And so I think that's why it becomes a platform or a venue for those kind of moments.
So given that, go ahead, Ernest.
No, I was going to say, I mean, it is one of those things. And it's one of those where it's one of the events where we all sort of come together and it's not an event that, you know, people are going to fight over. Other than, you know, the players on the field.
But look at the Taylor Swift. That's what struck
that's
me.
True.
Normally, this is an event that brings people together. That's and, you know, not everybody's a football fan. I understand that. A lot of people watch the Super Bowl for the snacks, you know, because you're at a party with your friends.
It's a party, yeah.
And it's a party. But normally, and so that's what makes the trailer controversy so striking, because you think, wow, even the Super Bowl, we're polarizing that.
Right.
But I do think
the fact that the president is not
that's
going to play
what
a
I
second
was, that's
year
what
in
I was
row.
Going to say
the president
exactly
is
there.
Saying, like, nah, I'm good.
So the president saying, nah, I'm good.
Yeah.
Is he? Or is it just a matter of, like, staying out of the fray?
I think it's both. I mean, I think he's sort of like, you know what? I'm gonna let the public enjoy the Super Bowl.
Okay.
Why should I interject myself into something?
So that's
that,
not about him.
I
think it's about him in the sense that he doesn't want to give people a beef. I think politicians who try to interfere with sports are really, that is a third rail. You don't want to see a politician when you go to the football game. And inevitably, you'll see a politician show up at some big college game or some big match.
Right.
And they're booed when they get introduced because people don't want to see that.
Right.
And so I think that's what Biden's decision, it's a politically strategic decision.
I would agree.
Not to do that.
I would agree.
So you think now that it's been 2 years in a row, does this start kind of a new trend? Do you think this is something that it's going to be one of those things that eventually starts to die out? Like the network being like, you didn't do it last year. You're not doing it this year. Maybe we'll just reclaim that time and it'll eventually be one of those things that goes away.
I think it depends on his predecessor.
Okay.
I really do think
successor.
Successor. I keep saying predecessor. Yeah.
No, that's all right.
Because his
unless
predecessor
you're,
loved
you're,
it. His predecessor loved it.
Yeah. Unless you're being prescient.
I think it does. Depend on who's going to be, who's the next president is. Yeah. He or she may decide to continue on not being involved in the biggest appointment television that we have left.
Okay. In more than 10 years that Ernest and I, at least, have been doing this show, we've talked about showbiz. We've talked about changes at Sesame Street and where and how it's viewed. Never, though, have we done what I'm about to do. And truth is, I never thought that there would be a reason to until last week when the super creative social media team behind the Sesame Street characters posted what seemed to be an innocuous enough tweet from Elmo's account, just checking in and asking how everyone was doing. I was going to bring this up last week, Kathy, when we were talking about burnout, but we ran out of time. Elmo found out how people were doing in the form of hundreds of thousands of responses to that tweet from people who were doing, well, not so well. In the Children's Television Workshop, folks found themselves having little choice but to address that collectively, that we are not okay. Elmo worked the circuit, doing TV shows up and down the dial, talking about the response that no one expected. Here he is with CNN's Jake Tapper.
Elmo, were you surprised by all of the responses? And why do you think this simple question coming from you, Elmo, resonated with so many human beings and adults?
Well, you know, Elmo's not really sure. Elmo was surprised because Elmo didn't realize that when you ask someone how they're doing, you have to be ready because maybe someone's not doing well or maybe somebody is. But it's an important question to ask, and Elmo's learned a lot about that.
Yeah, so Elmo learned a lot about the importance of active listening there. And there's a lot to unpack, because just as much as I never thought I would be including a soundbite from Elmo in this program, What do you think the chances are that Jake Tapper thought he was going to be doing an interview with Elmo?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. Elmo is an artifact of the pre-internet era,
yes,
if you think about it.
One of my favorite Muppets since about the time I was 12 or 11.
Yeah, and who doesn't like Elmo?
I love
I'm
Elmo.
Sure there are some haters out there who don't like Elmo.
Yeah,
I shouldn't have said that.
No, I'm not an Elmo
okay.
hater. No.
Okay, just checking.
But I think... you know, this reminds me very much of, and it was in a documentary that was screened here during True False, when Mr. Rogers mm-hmm. came back after 9/11 to talk to people about, and, you know, ostensibly it was talking to children, but really it was talking to a whole generation of people who grew up with Mr. Rogers. And I think it was one of the most affecting moments, certainly of that movie, but also of Mr. Rogers' career, that there are cultural touchstones, mm-hmm. I think, that that people really are drawn to. And I think for a lot of people who grew up with Elmo as a figure in their childhood, having that character ask you how you're doing probably touched something really deep inside that that we normally don't touch.
I think people were more willing to honestly answer the question
mm-hmm.
because
exactly.
it came
yes,
from Elmo,
yes.
as opposed to maybe even their own therapist mm-hmm. or a family member or something. I think it was just like, wow. Elmo,
yeah, because it takes people back to being a child
yeah, right? yeah, yeah.
when you're vulnerable and open.
Yeah.
And it speaks to how we process collectively right now. And, you know, you talked about the strategic communication parts of this. Wow, the social media team, who knows if it really, really was just kind of like, hey, how's it going? And it just came in this massive trauma dump. But this has really opened up a lot of doors for the Children's Television Workshop to really gain a new audience and adults that it hadn't connected with previously. They are some of the most brilliantly run social media accounts. I've been following them and sharing them for months, but now it's also a new avenue for donors too.
Right. No, absolutely. I mean, you know, these are people who, again, it's that honesty that comes out that's not connected to any particular group or any political ideology or anything like that. He just asked a simple question, but it's not just the question itself. It's where did the question come from? And there was probably this conversation among those at the Children's Television Workshop mm-hmm. basically saying, hey, you know, we always ask each other these questions. What about our characters asking the question?
Well, and I love when Elmo said to Jake Tapper, like, Elmo learned a whole lot about, yeah. like, sometimes you're asking somebody a really simple question, and then you realize you got to be ready for the answer.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and when you ask about would Jake have been surprised, you know, Jake's of the generation
yeah.
that grew
oh, yeah.
up with Elmo.
And has kids who
people,
grew up with
people
Elmo.
People wanted to hear from
yeah.
Elmo. They
right.
didn't want to hear from the voice behind Elmo, the person. They wanted to hear from Elmo because
right.
that's who they were talking to mm-hmm. on social media.
Right. No, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. Before we go, I want to take a second to highlight a new member of the KBIA program family, the Daily Blend. On Monday, Adonica Coleman officially joined the KBIA family, bringing her program at the time when you may have been used to hearing Radio Friends with Paul Pepper. AC tells us that her new program will focus on Mid-Missouri's nonprofit communities, and we're excited to have her with us and hope you'll check out the Daily Blend at 8:50 on weekday mornings and online at kbia.org. Well, we are pretty much out of time for this week. Thank you for joining us. RJI's Travis McMillan directs our show. We've got Takiya Thomas running our audio. Tim Pilcher did our theme music. And Nate Brown is our social media manager.